I really like being read. It's all about being read, which might sound obvious, but it's not about, hey man, I just really need to express myself.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. That was the Times columnist Hugo Rifkind. Back in March, I arranged to go and visit Hugo at his home in North London. I don't know if you remember early March, it was like a different, you know, different era to the day I record this, which is in late May. Coronavirus was sort of on the radar, but we didn't really understand the extent of it at the time. There was no lockdown. We weren't even being told to self-isolate at that point with a cough or any of the symptoms. So when I woke up on the morning of my interview with Hugo and found that I had a bit of a cough, I wasn't quite sure what to do. I texted him and I said, I've got this mild cough. I don't think it's anything more, but, you know, would you like to rearrange? And Hugo sent me one back saying, you know, we could probably drive ourselves mad worrying about these things. I'm sure it's fine. You know, we've got plenty of hand sanitizer. So off I went across London, and I was careful. Luckily, I didn't shake hands with him, and I washed my hands constantly that day. But afterwards, as I walked home, it was a lovely, warm, sunny day. I noticed that I was shivering, which was a little bit of a worry. And by the time I got home, I had a full-blown fever, and I was then more or less in bed for the next 6 days. So not great timing to have gone to someone's house. Luckily, Hugo was very gracious about it and didn't really develop any symptoms, although he's a bit suspicious that he may have had a bit of a loss of taste and smell the following week. So who knows? But you will hear a bit of ominous coughing from me in the background of this episode. So sorry about that. Hugo's study was the last one that I was able to visit in person. It's at the top of a beautiful house in North London, full of family life. His dog followed us up there and sat at his feet while we talked. Hugo writes three columns for The Times, for which he's won several awards. They include his opinion column on a Tuesday. So, for example, this week it was about the Education Secretary's handling of coronavirus in schools. He also does a TV column on a Saturday, and also on a Saturday, My Week, which, if you haven't seen it, is a very funny satirical diary column written on behalf of someone in the public eye. So recent examples have included Donald Trump suggesting that condoms over the head could be a good way to control the spread of the virus, and Prince Harry tackling his first Ocado order in his new life as a normal person. Hugo is also a regular on Radio 4, and he'll be heading up a show on the soon-to-launch Times Radio. In this interview, he gives a really interesting insight into the mind of a newspaper columnist, from the weekly panic of finding something to write about for his opinion column to how he approaches writing and structuring his satire pieces. So, over to Hugo. Okay, so here we are in your study. Will you describe the room for me?
Sure, it's a ludicrous big room at the top of my house. It wasn't meant to be this big, but when we moved in, this was supposed to be my oldest daughter's bedroom, and there's a little room down the stairs that I clocked as a study, and then she decided she wanted a little room like Harry Potter. Not literally under the stairs like Harry Potter,
but it's not a cupboard.
Harry Potter type room. So I'm pretty soon it'll get taken from me, this room, I reckon. But it's quite big. It's got an old kitchen unit in it. I basically have two kitchens, like Ed Miliband. It's like, I guess it was a bedsit once at the top of my house, so it's got a sort of kitchen sink type thing with some cupboards. And my desk is next to the window. I've got this white desk that is half built by me and half from IKEA. The window has a glorious view over to Alexandra Palace. When we moved here, I had my desk right in front of the window, and I spent my whole time looking out the window at the birds and the trees.
Was it too distracting?
I did nothing. I had to move it, so I now have my back to the window. And then I've got a big TV, which is bigger than, again, that was an eBay purchasing disaster. It was meant to be smaller, but I got my inches and centimetres confused. But I am a TV reviewer, so I spend a lot of time watching that. And other than that, it's just mainly full of books and junk.
And what are your favourite things in here?
Wow. My dog's in here right now, so he'll do. He's called Ziggy. He's a schnauzer. What are my favourite things in here? I don't know, really. I like... So there's that... Actually, that picture on the wall there. Actually, there's two pictures on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is of a sort of market stall in Jerusalem. My cousin Paul, who's a photographer, took that. And I like that. And the other one is of a sort of fake band poster my friend Rachel made after we went to Glastonbury. And I quite like that. I don't know if that's my favourite thing in here. I think my computer is my favourite thing in here. I'm really boring. I don't know.
That's a little bit of a soulless choice.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I don't know. I've got my guitars. I've got...
You've got a dartboard. Do you actually...
It's a fake dartboard.
Oh,
it's a magnetic dartboard. Someone gave me that for a 40th birthday present, I think.
Do you use it?
Sometimes, although it's not very... I mean, have a go if you want. It's not... It doesn't... The darts don't stay to it very well. They tend to bounce off and it's just... Yeah.
So how often are you in here?
I'm in here all day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and some other mornings and evenings, depending on how behind with my general work I am.
Okay, but if you are having a day of working here, do you work consistently all day?
Yes. Well, I'll go out and walk the dog. I might go for a run. I might pick up the kids from school sometimes, but I work quite long days. Yeah, I work sort of 9 to 6 or so most days.
And are you solidly, well, I'm sure you're not solidly writing because there must be research time and watching shows and all of that. How many hours of writing do you think you could do in a day?
How many could I do in a day?
No, how many do you do in a day? Yeah.
I mean, it depends on what I'm doing. So like I write an op-ed column on Mondays or Tuesdays, and that keeps me actually writing from, I'd say, 9 till about 4.
How many words is that?
900.
Right.
But it's sort of hard because it's thinky op-ed. And if I've got a feature that I'm deep into, like a long, long feature, I'll write, you know, hours and hours. But, I mean, generally, I'm quite a quick writer.
Mm-hmm. And you said that you spend some days in the Times office as well. Do you get much writing done there?
Well, I go in to write. I write editorials for the paper 2 days a week. So I kind of have to. You know,
right?
I tend not to write much byline stuff in the office. Sometimes if I've got a big magazine feature, I'll plug it in the office and put on some pair of headphones and sit there for 12 hours.
Yeah,
that can work. But I tend to prefer not to write in the office
because you like peace and quiet, or
kind of. Well, just because I have to go to meetings and things, and people want stuff. I mean, I can sort of write. I can sort of write anywhere. Like I've written some of my best things, you know, on a sort of bench at a railway station type stuff. I'm quite lucky in that. I'm sitting in tents sometimes, actually. I've written quite a lot in tents. But I prefer not to be in the office when I can.
Right. Yeah. When do you first remember writing?
I mean, I always wrote stories and stuff as a kid. I was quite a lazy kid at primary school. Well, quite messy. So I had really bad handwriting. So I didn't do very well at primary school. I did quite well in exams and stuff, but during your general classroom teaching stuff, I never got praise for homework and stuff like that, except for stories. Stories always went quite well. And I can remember, must have been about 6, and you'd get a gold star if you got... No, you get a silver star if you did good homework, and you got a gold star if you got 3 silver stars. And I was the sort of kid who would never get a gold star, but I remember I wrote 2 stories and got silver stars for them. And then the third story was about a field mouse making a house inside a combine harvester because he jumped over the blades, and I was really proud of it, and I handed it in, and I didn't get a silver star because the teacher thought it was unrealistic, and so I never got my gold star. That's the only story.
Unrealistic.
I remember as a kid.
That's quite a harsh charge for a primary school child.
Yeah, I thought it was harsh. Yeah.
That's outrageous. So was there somebody who encouraged your writing?
Not particularly. I mean, my parents were both quite bookish. You know, my mum was a big reader, so she certainly encouraged me in reading, but in writing generally, no. I mean, I didn't think of myself as a writer, even a potential writer, until I was in my early 20s, I guess.
And so what caused that shift?
I suppose I kind of wanted to write for a long time in some sort of way. And I definitely did as a teenager. But I had no... I mean, it's a weird thing. You never know if you're any good or not. You can't tell if you're any good. And other people's writing is always much more thrilling than your writing because it's unexpected.
Yeah.
It's very, it's almost impossible to look at your own writing and know if it's any good or not, unless you've got a particular sort of brain, which I'm sort of better at it now because I understand it on a very technical level. But and so I can sort of remember being, I wanted to write a novel, I suppose, when I left university, but only because what else was I going to do? You know, I'd been backpacking and I'd sort of run out of options. And so while I was temping, I was trying to write a novel. And I got a job on a gossip news website at the time, and it turned out I was quite good at writing, and it was just sort of this sort of thrilling kind of, oh shit, like the thing I really want to do, it turns out I actually can do.
Yeah.
You know, and I hadn't expected that at all. So I've only really thought of myself in a sort of writing sense since then. Or it wasn't even so much whether I like it. I still can't quite decide whether I like it. It was just being told you were good at it. I hadn't been told I was good at anything for ages. It was great, you know.
You still aren't sure whether you like it or not?
I sometimes like it. I like having done it. I really like being read. I probably like it more than I would other jobs, although it's quite a long time since I had another job. I certainly like writing more than I like the research. I'm a very miserable reporter. I don't enjoy reporting. I don't enjoy, you know, going out and meeting people and finding stuff. I enjoy having found stuff out. I enjoy putting the puzzle together. But during election times, they always send us out at the paper. They send us out to go and wander around some bit of the country we've never been to before and speak to people about Brexit and stuff. And you speak to 50 people in a day, and I hate that. So I guess I...
Why do you hate it?
Because it only means something once you've spoken to a lot of people and you put it all together, and people don't necessarily want to speak to you, and people are quite defensive, or they're mad. A lot of the time they're really mad.
A lot of the time it's the mad ones who do want to talk to you.
Yes, and well, it's a process that if you're wandering around some market town looking for people to speak to, you're going to end up, there's people on benches, they're mad. People in bookshops are always mad. You know, it's sort of old people and dog walkers, and they're not very representative, so you've got to... Yeah, so that wasn't even the question. What was it? Do I enjoy writing? Sometimes I really enjoy it. If I can tell it's going well while I'm doing it, I really enjoy it. Whereas sometimes it's just a bit of a slog. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got this job on the gossip website.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of gossip were you writing about?
So it was this website called People News. It was started by this woman, Jane Proctor, who had been the editor of Tatler. And I got a job there because I was living with my friend John in, where were we? We were living in Camberwell, and we were both temping. He was about to start film school, and I was sort of trying to write a book, but not with any great success. And we were temping in a sort of data entry firm, and then he got moved by the agency to go and work for this, to be an admin assistant at this internet incubator. And one of the things that they were launching, it's like the first dot-com boom. This is like 99, I guess, 98, 99. And one of the websites they were launching was this one, People News. And they were looking for writers. So I sort of sent in a CV, and I had a meeting with Olivia Stewart-Liberty, who turned into a friend of mine, and basically they had a bunch of people that they'd poached from newspapers. And they took me in as the office junior on twice what I'd been earning temping, so that was pretty good. And I just, yeah, and I was there for about a year, I suppose.
Doing what?
So they were like writing a, initially my job was writing a, like an encyclopedia of celebrities. Because the idea was, again, this is very early internet stuff, but we were very excited about it at the time. The idea was when you had someone's name came up in a story, you'd be able to click on the name and a card that told you everything about them would pop up.
That's actually a really good idea.
You'd think, but it burnt a lot of money and you didn't find it online now, so it can't be that good an idea. But so I had to write, I don't know, a number of them a day. And then this is before the website launched, and then when it did launch, no, that's what it was. I got, as part of my job doing that as well, they wanted me to write a roundup of the newspaper, all the newspapers every day, and send it around the office so people knew what was going on. And so I started doing that every day, and I quite enjoyed doing that, and people started to like reading it. And so then when the website launched, they made that into a column. And then from there I basically got spotted by someone in the Times.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been at the Times since when?
I started writing for the Times in 2001. but I've been staff there since 2000 and maybe 4 or 5.
So you've been there for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's unusual, I think.
Mm. Yeah, there's a few of us. There's a few who've been there longer than me, but not that many.
But I mean, for anyone in journalism to have a job, you know, yeah, to be at the same company for that long is unusual.
I mean, I wrote for other people for the first 5 years. I was freelance as well.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So you were sort of already a columnist at that point.
At which point?
When you went to the Times.
Well, kind of. I mean, I wrote a daily roundup of the news, or had done for a bit, and then I just started running features freelance for Times 2 about sort of haircuts and celebrities and very, very trivial stuff.
That's what I do now.
No, much, much more trivial. Like, way more trivial.
At what point did you become a columnist?
So,
and how did that happen?
In maybe 2005 or thereabouts, they offered me a job as the diarist, as the gossip diarist. I'd written quite a lot. I'd been doing quite a lot of features before then. I mean, I'd done like sort of cover stories, and I'd written for the magazine and things quite a lot. I'd been freelance for them for 4 years or so. And their diarist, Andrew Pierce, was he leaving? No, he was going to become a reporter. And I think they told him he was only allowed to stop writing the diary column if he'd found someone else who'd write it. And for me, I really didn't want to be a diarist. I don't really like diaries very much. And I certainly didn't want to have to go to parties and speak to celebrities and stuff. Because it sounds ridiculous. It sounds incredibly sort of, you know, first world problem to say that.
But no, but it's really mortifying.
It's a really horrible way to spend your time.
Yeah.
But there was I'd been trying for a while to get the Times to give me a job, and they wouldn't. And this was a way to get a job. So I thought, well, I'll do that for 6 months.
Yeah.
And I did it for, I think, 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, would it be fair to say that your primary job is columnist?
Yeah, I guess.
And you're doing 3 columns for the Times?
Yes. I do. I don't know what my job title might be, features writer or maybe leader writer. I'm not sure. But I do three. I do an opinion column on Tuesdays. And on Saturdays, I do My Week, which is a sort of satirical diary in the voice of somebody else, and a TV column.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that perhaps a lot of people don't realise how difficult being a columnist, I imagine, must be in terms of sustaining a column over a long period of time and always having something interesting to say. I mean, I know a lot of journalists who've had columns and have found it sort of nightmarish, actually, the pressure to keep coming up with something new every week. How do you approach that?
Sort of in just tumbling panic kind of way. I mean, I've been writing the difficult ones, the op-ed column, the opinion column, you know, TV reviews, a TV review.
Then you've got the subject matter handed to you. Yeah.
Subject that, I mean, I don't really, even my TV review is a bit more column-y in that there's a bit less TV and more me in it, frankly. And the funny one is, well, it's different, sort of challenging, I suppose. But the op-ed column is just, particularly because I write on Monday. So I used to write that column for a Friday. I mean, you write it on a Friday, you basically have the week to put together an idea. Pitch it on the Thursday morning, and it ran on the Friday. Now, writing on a Monday for Tuesday, theoretically you can come up with an idea over the weekend, but the news just doesn't work like that. The news starts each week on a Monday. And so generally I wake up on a Monday morning with nothing, and by 9 o'clock I've somehow communicated to the comment desk at the paper.
That's
what I'm
very
writing
early. So what time do you start thinking about it?
Maybe 8:30. No, I mean, I'll think about it. I'll wander around sort of growling downstairs, sort of ignoring my children and snapping at my wife while I try and think of something on a Monday morning, listening to the radio and just trying to get something to spark. But it's kind of weird because it is a sort of nightmarish process, but I've been writing some sort of opinion column now. I was a columnist for the Herald before I went to the Times full time. So since maybe 16 years, I've been doing some sort of opinion column at least once a week. And I've always had an idea in the end. It's always worked. So, you know, although it's kind of like a ridiculously stressful process to go through, I've never not come up with the goods in time. So on one level you're intensely relaxed that it's going to be fine, even while you're sort of pacing around trying to figure
sweating
out what the fuck to do. Yeah.
Do you think it takes a certain personality type to be good at an opinion column? I mean, in the sense that you have to be somebody opinionated, I assume.
Well, I mean, not really, because I'm not very opinionated. I'm not. That's partly why I find that bit of it so difficult, I think, in that there are some opinion columnists who just, they just know what they think about everything, and they have, I mean, they have like, I had this conversation with Catelyn Moran once, and she was talking about how she has like 50 ideas that she could write in any one given moment. And it's, I mean, it's a different sort of column, in fairness, but, you know, and she just decides which one and goes with it. You know, I write every idea I ever have. I don't have ideas.
You don't have spare. You don't have a bank of spares.
Hell no.
In case of emergency.
No, I've got nothing. And I'm kind of, and actually my, sometimes I think my opinions themselves are really not enough to have kept me in 20 years of journalism. I don't really think anything very interesting. But I think I'm quite good at writing them. I think of myself more as a writer than a pundit, really.
Is it a job that attracts a lot of interaction with readers? I mean,
it can.
I imagine that you hear from people a lot.
Yeah, it can attract. Well, there's different sorts of interaction with readers. There's like the nice interaction with readers is the stuff about the Saturday columns, and it's people who just enjoy reading you, and you bring them a bit of pleasure,
yeah.
And they want to talk about it and tell you about it, and that's kind of wonderful. You get a lot more angry interaction. For an opinion
on a Tuesday,
column.
Yeah.
Some of which is from readers, some of which is just from, you know, I mean, people. Well, a lot of it's from people who have not read it and have no intention of reading it, but are very angry about the headline.
I know. I always laugh at your. You've got a Twitter bio that says, yes. "Well, I didn't write the headline."
I didn't write the headline. Though, yeah. No, which is a bit, I occasionally feel a bit guilty about, because of course
somebody did.
The comment desk who do write the headlines. I work with very closely, but So people. Yeah, it can be quite... I mean, that's fair enough. You know, you're expressing an opinion. People have other opinions. People don't necessarily mean to be as nasty as they often sound. And then, if I write a column, I'm quite often nasty about people, frankly, in my columns, so I should be able to take it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I was going to actually ask about the TV column.
Yeah.
So you're a TV critic. You write very entertaining reviews every week. I've done a bit of reviewing of various things over the years, and I'm always slightly haunted by a guilty conscience about saying that something that somebody's made is not good.
Yeah.
I suppose because we're all people who are making things and putting them out there. Is that something that is ever on your mind? And I'm not saying in any way that you're sort of doing a hatchet job on lots of, you know, but does it worry you ever?
Not as much as it should. I mean, in that I because I'm quite old and I've been doing this for a while, and because I'm kind of I know a lot of writers and people like that, quite a lot of the time I'll review something, and really right at the end I'll suddenly figure out that I know the person who wrote it, maybe not well. Or that, I trashed the last series of The Crown a bit, and literally realised after it had run that I'd sat next to Peter Morgan at a dinner 6 months earlier, and I just thought, what must he have thought? And it just hadn't occurred. You know, I tend not to think of TV as being a thing written by a person, which I know sounds ridiculous, but I just don't, and that makes it much easier to write about. I mean, fortunately, it doesn't actually happen that often. That I end up slagging off something that someone I know has been involved in.
Yeah.
But it does happen. Yeah.
Do you have any sort of vague policy in mind of how many good things you want to review compared to how many bad things you want to review?
No, not at all. No, it just depends what sort of comes up that week. But I also, because of the way the column works, I'll always try and do, I generally do the first, you know, I generally do three or four programs, sometimes two, but because of the way the column works, the first one, there's got to be something to say about it, to have a comment. Like, and it's not really a review secretly, it's a TV conversation column, it's let's have a chat about what was on telly this week kind of column. And so I think it's just a bit boring to say, well, this was on and I liked it and it was good because of this. I mean, I'm not that knowledgeable about TV, I just watch a lot of it. Yeah, so it never. I mean, I try not to just say everything's rubbish, because if you just say everything's rubbish, then people wonder why you're bothering
why you're
writing
doing
about
it.
That rather than something else. Yeah.
So let's talk about my week.
Right.
How long have you been doing that?
Oh,
long time.
Yeah, I think probably 14 years now. there's a book. I did a book of them.
Yeah.
There, and that book was at least 6 years ago.
So,
yeah.
So, what is the art of it? How do you approach that?
It's a weird column in that it's got. I've been doing it for that long, and I would say it has got harder.
Really?
Rather than easier.
Why is that?
Because I used to just do it in a very sort of fun, carefree fashion. Here's a person who's been in the news. Let's imagine what they've been thinking. I started doing it when I was a gossip diarist, because I hated being a diarist. And it was a way to not have to write a diary again Friday for Saturday. And I said, will you let me? I said to the then Saturday editor, George Brock, can I do something funny on that day? And he said, well, we'll try it and see how it goes. And I thought I'd get away with it for a week or two, and decade and a half later. So it used to just be quite silly, really. I mean, it's still silly, of course it's silly. But and then I got a lot more thoughtful about how to do it and how to structure the comedy. And there was a long time where I thought to myself, what you've got to do in something like that. I'd looked at how The Simpsons worked. And The Simpsons, an episode of The Simpsons basically has three plots in it. So I'd try and write a week that had three plots in it, you know.
That's so interesting.
And I don't do that anymore.
Don't you?
No, but I think it maybe happens a bit more instinctively, that kind of thing. There was a long period of time when it started really working, when it got, if I'm allowed to say, good. That was when I was thinking very carefully about the structure, because a lot of the jokes are referring back to something that's happened before and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this, actually, because I was thinking each one is almost it's a sort of short piece of short fiction, isn't it? And
yeah.
I wondered if in your mind it has an arc.
Yes.
To it.
I mean, not always, but often. And it's the arc that makes it work. I mean, because there was a period of time where, you know, obviously Craig Brown does something quite similar in Private Eye, but it's not really similar, because he writes a parody. It looks superficially similar, but it's not a diary in the same sort of way. It's a parody. But there was a time when quite a few other papers started running similar columns, and they were always really bad, to the extent that I'd read them and go, shit, does mine look this bad? And I don't think it ever did. And I think the reason is because people would just literally do that. They'd start at the beginning and wait till they got to the end, and none of it would have any narrative with itself.
Mm.
Sounds off. It's a really grandiose way to talk about a very silly column. But yeah, and so it was very important to have some kind of structure running through it. But whereas now, basically in the last 3 or 4 years, I really, really concentrate on the news content of it. I really make sure, I really go through what has this person been doing this week, what events have been going on. If I'm writing about someone in politics, I'll speak to our politics reporters often and say, what's the subtext here? What do people say about this person and all that kind of stuff? It's just getting increasingly more work as I get increasingly obsessive about it.
But is it deeply satisfying? It sounds like it would be.
Eventually. Again, I quite often, by the time I finish it on a Friday, think it's just the worst one I've ever done. I mean, often, like more often than not, I think it's the worst one I've ever done. And then I'll sometimes I'll get an email from someone in the office saying, oh, that's a good one this week. And oh, shit, is it? But mainly it's sort of, you put it out there. It's the one I really wait for. You sort of put it out there and I wait and see when the comments turn up and what Twitter says about it. And I generally don't know if it's any good until then.
Right.
And I normally think, yeah, normally when I file that column, I think, well, last week's was good, this is shit, but I'll get away with it. And then it turns out, and when I think that the most, it generally turns out to go down quite well.
Yeah. And it's also, of all the things that you do on a regular basis, it's the most obviously comic, and it's probably your biggest opportunity of the week to be funny. Is that sort of using that muscle quite important to you? I mean, you're obviously good at it.
I think so. I mean, it's more. So, in what's good about that in terms of being comic is it's like it's got to be comic. It's got to be comic in a way. Like sometimes there's a couple I've written. Like I did whenever it was 2 years ago, the Harvey Weinstein one I did was not funny. You know, it was basically all about him. It was all about basically him being sexually harassed in places. You know, by and finding it very upsetting. And there was nothing in that that would have made you laugh or made anyone laugh. But normally, if that column's not funny, unless you really hate someone, which I don't normally, then there's just no point to it. You can't just lie for 600 words, pretend, what, 700 words, and pretend that people have been doing this stuff. So the joke rate's got to be quite high. Like, almost like, it's almost as tightly written as tweets are, if you see what I mean, in that you can't spend 30 words, 40 words setting up a joke. There's got to be more or less a joke a sentence, really. What was the question? Oh, yeah, so the comic muscle. It's only the comic muscle. I mean, there'll be a deeper point sometimes, but that's normally just useful if there's one there, if you see what I mean. Yeah.
Do you ever hear from the subjects of your My Week?
Sometimes. I'm trying to think who. I did one a couple of years ago. I did a Jacob Rees-Mogg one, and he brought that up when I met him at Cheltenham, claiming to have enjoyed it. Maybe he did. Sometimes you hear about, like, politicians who've got them on their fridges, and you think, well, that's not what I wanted, because you were supposed to hate it. You know? The weirdest was years and years ago, really long time ago, more than 10 years ago, I did Mohammed Al-Fayed, and he got his press guy to write one of me in retaliation about how I'd been spending, which was kind of really flattering in a way, because it suggested I'd sort of spend my week, I don't know, like sort of hanging out with supermodels in Kensington or whatever. And it was like, oh, I live in Brixton. And I, you know. So yeah, you do sometimes hear back from people. It's a really vicious thing to do to somebody, to write that kind of thing about them. It's like, you know, I write interviews quite often, and I worry sometimes writing interviews, because an interview, you're basically, you know, you're trying to get somebody's soul and put it on paper, and your interpretation of it might almost certainly doesn't suit their interpretation of themselves. You know, I've been interviewed, a written interview, and you see what somebody thought of you, and you're kind of like, well, that's just not even slightly me. You know, that is the experience of being interviewed. But that column, it's like, it's way more than that. You know, it is like trying to own somebody. And so I can imagine it's probably incredibly violating to have somebody write about you like that, but I try not to think about that too often.
When you write your various columns, what are you striving for? And I'm sure it differs from one to the next, you know, from the different formats.
I really like being read. It's all about being read. So it's all about how it's going to be taken by readers. So it's not, which might sound obvious, but it's not about, hey man, I just really need to express myself. You know, I don't really, it's not about what's coming from me. It's about whether people enjoy reading it or whether people have a thought-provoking experience.
So you're striving for some sort of connection.
Yes, yes, definitely. It's all about what happens at the other end.
Yeah. You also wrote a novel.
Yes.
Overexposure.
It's up there somewhere behind me, yeah.
Yeah, and that was 2007.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested to hear that you loved writing stories as a kid, mm-hmm. and you said you were writing novels when you were... Yeah. younger. What was the experience of publishing that like for you, and have you thought about doing another novel?
Yeah, sure. So that one, weirdly, that's a novel about a gossip diarist, and I'd written it before I was a gossip diarist, and then I sold it to Canongate, because I did a feat. Remember that book about the pickup artist, The Game?
Yeah.
So I interviewed Neil Strauss, who wrote that, and it was basically the big interview about that book before it came out, which was I think it's basically the interview that got me my job at the Times as well, actually, because I think it was a cover story. I don't remember. And at the launch party for that, I was speaking to a couple of the guys from Canongate, and I said, oh, I've written a novel that I think that had been punted around, various publishers didn't want it, and they said, oh, we'd love to see it. And then they ended up publishing it. But what that meant was that when I went to... I'd been a gossip diarist for 4 or 5 months, and I already had a novel about it coming out. And people were like, how the fuck did you do that? You know? And actually, it had taken me a while. It wasn't the first novel I wrote. It wasn't the last novel I wrote either. So, I mean, I do hope at some point to publish another novel. But it's very... I mean, I write... You know, I write...
You're busy.
3,000 words a week for the paper. It's very difficult to get a book done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you'd have to probably take a sabbatical or something like that.
Yes. I mean, what I find with what I find with fiction, I mean, I certainly wouldn't say I've been writing constantly, but what I find with fiction projects is, in general, because of the journalism, I'm a very first draft writer. And
you mean that your first draft is almost often, a final draft?
Usually, more or less. Not totally.
That's amazing.
But more or less. It's kind of amazing, but what it means is that, I mean, you can't do that with a novel. You know, you write the first draft of a novel and it will be shit, or it won't quite make sense, or you haven't thought about it enough, or you only figure out who the characters are by the time you get to the end and all that kind of stuff. And so I've written a couple of first drafts, and I'm very much aware with everyone, well, no, you need to, you know, think about this for another year. And it's like, I don't think about a thing for a year. I can think about something till 5 o'clock that day, and then, you know, so eventually there are a couple of things I'm working on that I just need to write the fucking thing again.
Yeah.
But it's just very hard to make yourself do that.
As somebody who loves being read.
Yeah.
I mean, what's it, you know, you've worked on these things that nobody's seen, or not many,
yeah.
I don't know who's seen it, but what's that like? Don't you feel frustrated? Don't you want to get it out there?
Well, a bit, although, I mean, I do get read quite a lot. You know,
right, so
you
know, scratching,
I mean,
that itch.
I mean, a lot of it's, yeah, ego, right? Like, if I'd been more gamefully employed as a journalist, I'd never have written the novel that got published. You know, it is about wanting to be read, and so I don't know how to say it. I'm not desperate enough to be more read to write another novel.
Right.
I mean, I enjoy the writing process of novels, which is probably what's that. Actually, the exact opposite of everything else. Those are things I write because I enjoy doing it.
Right.
In the same way that I enjoy reading. Yeah. But I guess I'm not desperate enough to do the amount of work that you really need to do.
I mean, it blows my mind that so many people manage to publish novels. I just think the amount of work that's involved, and the amount of work that's involved before you even know whether it's going to be sold, and is, I just can't believe how many people stick at it.
Yeah, well, you'll notice I haven't. You know, I've regressed back to being an aspiring novelist again.
when you look back over your writing career, are there moments that stand out where you sort of had a breakthrough as a writer? I mean, are there lessons that you have hung on to?
Probably the first thing I learned when I started off as a features writer was about how to take inspiration from other writers, in that it's kind of fine to appropriate the style of other people, I reckon. It's fine, because you'll do it whether you want to or not. Even now, I'll write a column and I'll read it back over and I'll go, well, that, I don't know, that line's a bit Giles Corran, that line's a bit Marina Hyde, that line's a bit Catelyn Moran. That's kind of fine, you know, as long as you're not actually copying. I don't mind that at all. But where you go badly wrong, where a lot of new writers go badly wrong, particularly with journalism, is what they're doing is, rather than modelling themselves on a writer, they're modelling themselves on the idea of what they feel they ought to be doing.
Right.
So they try and write a gossip diary item that reads like a gossip diary item, or a style feature that reads like they believe style features ought to read. And that's just a absolute nosedive into sort of cliche and banality, you know. So learning not to do that quite early on was a major thing. And more recently, particularly again with feature writing and longer things, learning to sort of trust myself, learning that just get it out and it will be all right. You know, you will get all the information out and you can chop it up and move it around later if you want to. Not getting hung up on whether it's working right at the beginning, I think.
Did you, when you were younger, have periods where you got a bit stuck?
Not stuck as such, but there were periods where what I was doing didn't seem to work very well and I was trying to figure out why.
Rather than just keeping going?
Yes, well, or just, I mean, particularly with opinion columns, it's possible to get really confused writing an opinion column, because you think you know what you think, and then by the time you've written the thing, you realise you've made a completely different argument, and you've either run out of things to say at 400 words and you need to get another 500 from somewhere, or you get almost to the end and you haven't even begun to say what you're talking about, and so you've got to kind of sort of form this, you've got to reapproach what you're even trying to say with the whole thing, so as not to write it again. So I used to get in terrible tangles with opinion golems, which doesn't really happen so much anymore.
Yeah, and what are you proudest of in terms of your writing?
That's quite difficult because as we sort of started off saying, I think it's very hard to understand your own writing, and so the easiest thing to be aware that you're proudest of is the stuff that's actually quite different from what you normally do, you know, because it stands out to you.
Yeah.
So at the moment, I mean, the thing I'm proudest of that I wrote in the last year, say, I wrote a magazine feature about ethical pornography, for which I went to Barcelona, which was 4,500 words or something. There's a lot of work in that, and I covered some quite difficult issues, and I was really pleased with that, looking at it, how that worked. So in recent time, probably that. In general, I don't really know. I'm sort of proud to still be doing it. I'm proud to be all right at doing it. I kind of like it. Sort of, it's incredibly wanky to go on about awards, but it's really, really, it's a massive relief to win them. You know,
and you've won loads of them.
Well, I've won loads, but I've won enough to sort of not think, to not have to think, shit, should I really be doing this? You know, which is, and again, it's, maybe it sounds boastful, but really the experience is one of relief. It's like kind of, okay, fine, validated. I can carry on now. I don't need to worry about, should I have been a lawyer? You know, I've been a terrible lawyer. Yeah, so that kind of thing, maybe.
Well, that's all my questions. Thank you.
Okay, no, real pleasure.
That was Hugo Rifkind, who you can read on Tuesdays and Saturdays in The Times. Hope you enjoyed that one. Do rate and review the podcast if so. And I've got lots more brilliant writers of all kinds coming up. So see you next time.